people's ideas are fluid. People are fluid. That what you think today might not be what you think a week from now. But we can't do that if we have a posture of non-engagement. And so now, you know, it's clearer where things are at and the battles that will need to be fought. You know, and we have to really engage with that and create the tools that are necessary to try to win the mass movement that we need in order to be successful. And I'm, you know, I am optimistic about that just from what I saw in the streets this past summer. 15 to 26 million people, white people in places where there are no black people, who came out in defiance of public authorities to say that Black Lives Matter. I think that is an important foundation that our movement can build upon and grow in the ways that we want, that we think are important in this struggle for a better world. So thanks again for organizing this. It's been a great conversation.
That was a conversation sponsored by Haymarket Books, featuring Mark Lamont Hill, Philip Agnew, and Kianga Yamata Taylor about Dr. Hill's urgent new book, We Still Here: Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. You can find more information on the book, We Still Here.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
On this edition of Let's Talk About Race, we have the post-election blues. The Faith Report will review the movie Come Sunday, and Book Love will talk to church ladies. All this and more coming up on this edition of Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
On this edition of Let's Talk About Race, we were scheduled to discuss the post-presidential election results. We wanted to start off like this. But we ended up like this. So this show was supposed to be full of post-election analysis. And unfortunately, it's full of anxiety and tension because of what's going on.
This afternoon, the Trump campaign filed a lawsuit to stop the counting of ballots in Pennsylvania. That is simply wrong. It goes against the most basic principles of our democracy. It takes away the right of every American citizen to cast their vote and to choose our leaders. Our election officials at the state and local level should be free to do their jobs without fear, without intimidation, without attacks. These attempts to subvert the democratic process are simply disgraceful. We're going to fight every single attempt to disenfranchise voters. We will continue to administer free and fair elections in Pennsylvania. Let me be clear. In Pennsylvania, every vote is going to count. I'm going to fight like hell to protect the vote of every Pennsylvanian. We have to have fair elections, and those elections have to be free of external influences. We need to have confidence that people are choosing their leaders and that the leaders are not choosing the people who vote for them.
surely yet another blow to Trump's outlandish bid to get his defeat overturned.
Yes, because this recount was something that the Trump campaign was initially pushing for. They had sent a team of leading Republican figures here in Georgia to really lead the way into this recount effort, even though this was something that was done by the state officials, that was mandated by this audit that was required by the new Georgia state law. And what this recount, this hand recount, found is that there were several thousands, about 6,000 votes that were uncounted initially, that were counted this time in this recount by hand. But in the end, Joe Biden, who had about a 14,000 vote lead heading into the recount, came out of that recount with about 12,800 votes ahead of Donald Trump. So very marginally changed there, the tally of the votes. The local officials who insisted throughout this recount process that it was simply a recount, there was no evidence of fraud, no evidence of irregularities, except those uncounted ballots that they eventually counted, and that the tally and the result, Joe Biden winning Georgia, did not change. Now, of course, Donald Trump not happy with that. He had already said that this recount was a joke, was a fraud. There was a campaign statement just after the announcement by the Georgia Secretary of State, that campaign statement saying that Georgia should not certify these results, that this recount was not valid. The certification set to be happening this Friday. After that, with this margin so close, under 0.5%, by law, the Trump campaign is allowed to request another recount. This one won't be done by hand, but by scanning. It is looking likely that Donald Trump is going to ask for that recount. But really, the push there is to try to get Republicans to refuse to certify this result, to try to delay this process, even though those results, this first count, the recount, have shown that Joe Biden has indeed won the state of Georgia.
And Ketevan, there's a fair bit of speculation around at the moment that in the face of a series of thwarted legal bids, the Trump campaign is actually shifting to something of a new strategy. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, yes, as you said, those legal challenges seem to be going nowhere. Most of them have already been thrown out by the courts. There is this attempt, of course, to try to delay the certification of some of the results in some of those key states. But the new strategy, really, and what we're seeing coming out of the Trump campaign, whether it's the president himself or some of his allies, is to try to basically get the state legislatures that are dominated by Republicans in some of those key states to try to overturn the will of the people, the vote of the people, by playing on the Electoral College. Because remember, all those states will give those Electoral College votes to the person who has won that state, who has garnered the most number of votes. But the Trump campaign is trying to push to get some of these Republican legislators to try to change that, to try either to pick electoral voters who are loyal to Donald Trump to try to vote differently, or even try to count on rogue electors to try to change that. The chances of that actually happening are slim to none, because some of those key states, those state legislatures controlled by the Republicans, I'm thinking about the state of Pennsylvania or the state of Michigan, have already said that there will not be a change in those Electoral College votes. Whoever won the state with the certified results will get the Electoral College votes. They've said that, even though they are Republicans, they will follow the will of the people. That's what they have said. And as far as rogue electors, the states since 2016 have tightened their rules on how Electoral College voters can cast their ballots. They can dismiss them, they can punish them. And so the chances of even a few rogue electors actually casting their ballot for Donald Trump, even though a state has voted for Joe Biden, are slim. And even if they do that, he would need a lot of those electors to change their votes, to change the will of the people in those states. And so the strategy is mostly to try to undermine the trust in the system. And that's what I saw earlier today here in Atlanta. in front of the state capitol, where Trump supporters came out, about 100 or 200 of them, saying that this vote was stolen, that the recount was a fraud, and that they did not believe in this election, that they would not believe the result, and that Donald Trump, for them, is the real winner.
Biden won. Trump is challenging. He's going back to that old trope of illegal votes, people that voted shouldn't have voted. To me, it mirrors our voter suppression show. Remember that show, y'all? Anyway, Althea, you want to chime in here? Aren't you I'm filled with anxiety and tension. Do you think Trump will get away with this?
I really don't. And it is definitely a different situation than we're used to. I think everybody's feeling a little bit off kilter that election results took much longer to, you know, solidify in our understanding of what really happened. But this whole year has been weird enough that it doesn't feel incredibly out of place to me. And while there is reason to be concerned about this, right? Like, Trump, Republicans will not congratulate or recognize that Joe Biden won. What their reasons for that are, I'm not entirely sure. There are reports of them saying privately that they know that Joe Biden won and that that's what the future is going to hold on January 21st, but that for whatever, you know, political reasons within their party, they're not doing that. What we are seeing with Trump right now is that his lawsuits are getting thrown out left, right, and center in terms of state level, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, all of those places that took a longer time to count and where there were allegations of voter fraud. I put that in air quotes because some of them have been recanted. But a lot of what these lawsuits depend on is this idea: when you want to bring a fraud lawsuit on the federal level, you have to have not just evidence that it happened, but also that the evidence matters, right? That it's going to be on the scale, that if there's a recount, if there's an audit, that it is going to make a difference to change the election results. And the margins that we're seeing are not indicating that. And there are law firms that had previously worked with Trump who are now firing him. I would also say that he doesn't really have the demeanor of a man trying to become an authoritarian in the sense of, you know, what do presidents turned autocrats do in this situation? You consolidate power, you toss out governors, you get control of the military. He's been busy firing security officials who say that the election was fair, and he's playing golf. And the U.S. Army has stood by statements that the election was the most secure in history. So I don't know, that it's possible that he won't ever admit, he won't ever concede, but conceding isn't a legal procedure. You don't have to concede. The election happens regardless of what one man thinks happened.
All right, Cecil, you seemed really confident that all these maneuvers that Trump is engaged in are just moot. They will not work. Will you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that what Althea mentioned is very important in terms of how the president is so-called challenging the election results. All of this will become moot on December 14th. That's the date when the electors selected by the voters in all 50 states will formally cast their votes for president and vice president. At that point in time, the Electoral College will elect formally Joe Biden and Senator Harris as president and vice president elect. It doesn't matter what the president, Trump, says or do. If they have to carry him out of the White House on January 20th, it might make good theater, but that will happen. It doesn't matter what he says or what he does. I think the thing that I'm afraid of is that all of his actions will continue to create a sense throughout the nations of an inability to trust the government, to trust facts, and it continues to lay a foundation that weakens democracy in our nation. And so long after Trump is out of the White House, we will continue to struggle with what type of nation we are and what type of institutions we trust. That's the sad legacy, not the election results. It's what will happen in the month and years ahead.
Professor Johnson.
Yes, I agree with Althea and Cecil in terms of their projections of what's going to happen. I think, yes, Biden will become president. And on January 20th, I guess that's Inauguration Day. I do think it's going to be a bumpy ride between now and then. I think every obstacle that Trump can throw in his way, he will. I don't think it's about wanting to stay in office. It may be about wanting to raise more money by being able to continue to reach out to his supporters for donations, and that the focus is really on those two Senate seats in Georgia. And that is hugely important, because if they get those two Senate seats, then the Democrats will not have a majority. Mitch McConnell will still be in charge, and we've already had 4 years of nothing, because Mitch McConnell will make sure that nothing happens. And I'm really concerned. I think Sherrod Brown, I believe, was one of the senators, was talking about the fact that the Senate has been doing absolutely nothing. The only thing that they have done is appoint judges to fill judgeships. And those judgeships are lengthy, you know, lifetime appointments, 18 years for the bench. So these are judges we're going to be stuck with for a generation. So that concerns me. How much will Biden be able to be to actually accomplish with Mitch McConnell as the majority leader in the Senate?
Nia Gray, you're our faith reporter. I have no faith in what's getting ready to come down. You want to give us some hope? And what's your analysis of what our other commentators have said regarding the election?
Well, I agree with all of our commentators. And what really bothers me is that it seems like Trump and his supporters are in this weird sort of deception lie cycle loop where he's on social media and they're supporting it on social media. And I think that's driving him to go out and do more stuff. His voters typically don't watch any other news. They're misinformed by social media. And even though social media has tried Facebook, Twitter, now even YouTube, that is starting to demonetize videos that are misinformation videos, still the information is getting to his supporters, and they just simply don't believe what the mainstream media says. In fact, there was a quote that Trump wants to be the king of this group, that his cohorts, perhaps starting a conservative news vehicle, perhaps a conservative version of Twitter where they can spout off whatever they want without being censored. I mean, the fact is that 75 million Americans voted for Trump, and they had that big sort of MAGMA march. It wasn't a million. It wasn't like the Million Man March, but they had a few thousand folks come out, and they're just all worked up into a frenzy. And my fear is, where does all of this negative energy get released even after January 20th?
So that segues into a very important point. The point is, although Biden and Harris won, what did they really win? Did they win a divided country where, because of Mitch McConnell running the Senate, he can't get anything through? The economy is crap. Or is crappier? Did Biden really, is this a win-win situation for Biden? Or would it have been better if Biden and Harris had lost? Because then Trump will be over a crappy show that he created. I see Professor Johnson is shaking her head, throwing things at me, so let's go to her first.
No, I think they've won. And I do think that our most presenting problem right now is COVID. And it's just out of control. And I do believe Biden will bring the appropriate professionals and scientists together. I think he will figure it out. Now, it would be nice if he could be working on that now. And the fact that Trump has blocked him from any connection with the White House or the COVID team at the White House, which I think is an example of how little he cares about American people. But I think that they will bring some logic to that and we'll see some things happen. And in that sense, I don't think the Senate is going to stand in their way. I mean, anybody looking at what's happening knows that this is our biggest priority right now. So no, I think Biden will help us. I don't think we could take another 4 years. I don't think we'd have a democracy if we had another 4 years of Trump.
Yeah, but you brought up a good point. After COVID, we're working, I'm editing the show now regarding the rental tsunami that's coming down. We don't have a financial plan put in place. I don't know if Biden could get that through the Senate. That's what I mean by he's going to govern what, Professor Johnson?
Well, I think, too, that there are some just bread and butter issues that I think Democrats and Republicans can probably come together on. One of them is, I think you're right, we're looking at the conclusion of the rent deferrals. We've got landlords who haven't been paid. And this is a good opportunity to show how ridiculous arguing that the stock market has anything to do with the economy, because the stock market is soaring, but people are really financially hurting, they're food insecure. I think they'll be able to come together around some of those issues, because America, is really at risk if we don't.
No, I think it's a win. I think it's absolutely a win. And I personally, and I, when I talk to my friends, I'm not going to let Donald Trump take this from us. You know, when they called the election and Kamala got up there and said, this is for all the little Black girls, all of the little girls that are watching. And it gave a lot of hope. In fact, one of Ava's little friends' big sisters wrote an article about it, because she's actually from India and her parents immigrated here, and she was so proud and just had this new sense of hope and purpose. And again, I'm not going to let Trump and his supporters take that away from us. Now, I think that under Trump, the GOP governs under fear. I don't know if Trump has videos, conversations. I don't know what he has on Lindsey Graham. I'm not the first person to say that. Local media in South Carolina is like, are there pictures? Is there video? And so maybe when they're not under the thumb of Trump, that they will wake up and come together for some COVID support to help support people so there isn't this tsunami, to help homeowners, also to repair our relationships overseas. I think the response from international leaders are like, don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. And that could be from Angela Merkel, from folks in Ireland. So I think the whole world has a sigh of relief. We're just waiting to see what happens with, you know, these lawsuits and things like that. But I, for one, am happy, and my daughter, my baby, is so happy to see those Trump signs out of our neighborhood.
Let's go to Althea and end that with Cecil.
Yeah, I think it's a win. When the race finally got called, I didn't necessarily get misty-eyed about a lot of it. I know that, you know, people on the left and progressives take issue with Biden, and even just the way that the primaries went, he wasn't really anybody's favorite. Democrats were more betting on, is he agreeable enough to the most amount of people so that Trump can get out of office? But at the very, very least, where we are in this third COVID spike right now, Biden is willing to do something about it. He's willing to fix it. And that's something that I think has even been out of the lexicon talking about politics for so long. Not this sort of like handshake bipartisan thing, but that there is room for movement here. But the way that Trump governed was with a chokehold, and that Republicans were going to win or they were going to do nothing at all. All of his campaign promises, I mean, we could talk forever about how none of his campaign promises really came true in meaningful ways, especially when it comes to legislating healthcare or anything that would really benefit like the majority of Americans. But that if Biden could get COVID somewhat under control, that would be a major victory, because it's just run rampant for the past 7 months. One thing I also wanted to mention when we're talking about what is Biden inheriting and what kind of havoc can Trump wreak in these, you know, waning days of his presidency, The CARES Act expires on December 31st, and there's a total stalemate between the House and the Senate of where we want to go next. There's a big discrepancy in what the Democrats and the Republicans' plans are and what they want to spend money on, how they want to relieve people. Democrats want to give people another $1,200 stimulus check and add more aid to unemployment assistance. Republicans are oriented towards a $300, whatever, it doesn't matter. Biden in office can move something like that along because he's willing to at least talk to people, not shut down the minority party entirely. And fundamentally, these are still elected officials. They are no longer under Trump's thumb going forward. You don't pass COVID, you don't support what recovery in your state, you're going to get voted out in 2022 and 2024.
Thank you. Cecil?
What is Trump's legacy? It is 11.6 million Americans who contracted the virus. It is 250,000 Americans dead. And as the other commentators have shared so eloquently, when Trump is gone, President Biden, who, whether we were enthusiastic for, supported him or not, was in the U.S. Senate for over 40 years. He has worked with Mitch McConnell. He knows how to make the deals. And so when so many states are now all over, every 50 state is threatened by COVID and hospitals are at the point of overflowing. Every state with Republican governors are now starting to say, oh, maybe you should wear a mask. I think that this crisis will bring people together to create movement to help save lives. And then, as people have noticed, we have an economy that is going down, down, down. Perhaps we will see whether President Biden and the U.S. population is able to wake up from the nightmare of Trump and begin to do work to begin to heal our nation.
The Fox News Decision Desk can now project that former Vice President Joe Biden will win Pennsylvania and Nevada, putting him over the 270 electoral votes he needs to become the 46th president of the United States.
Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States, who stated in this process, "I will never give up fighting for you and our nation," will be denied a second term. That has not happened since 1992 and President George H.W. Bush.
After four long, tense days, we've reached a historic moment in this election. We can now project the winner of the presidential race. CNN projects Joseph R. Biden Jr. is elected the 46th president of the United States, winning the White House and denying President Trump a second term. We're able to make this projection because CNN projects Biden wins Pennsylvania. The former vice president in his third run for the highest office, pulling off a rare defeat of a sitting commander-in-chief. With this victory, Kamala Harris is set to become the first woman and the first person of color to be the vice president. Again, CNN projects Joe Biden will become the 46th president of the United States. And Jake, he is now president-elect Joe Biden.
What a moment in history. We have all been waiting on the edges of our seats since Tuesday. It is the end of a tumultuous presidency, a time of some accomplishments, no question, a time where many Americans throughout the country and in shuttered steel towns and in rural America, they felt for the first time, they felt heard, which is important, but it is also, Wolf, it has also been a time of extreme divisions, many of the divisions caused and exacerbated by President Trump himself. It's been a time of several significant and utterly avoidable failures, most tragically, of course, the unwillingness to respect facts and science and do everything that could be done to save lives during a pandemic. It has been a time where truth and fact were treated with disdain. It is a time of cruelty, where official inhumanity, such as child separation, became the official shameful policy of the United States. But now the Trump presidency is coming to an end. To an end. With so many squandered opportunities and ruined potential, but also an era of just plain meanness. It must be said, to paraphrase President Ford, for tens of millions of our fellow Americans, their long national nightmare is over.
We did it. We did it, Joe. You're going to be the next president of the United States.
Throughout this process, a few Americans stood up and said, "Bye, Felicia," to Trump.
We also know that the Secretary of State and the Attorney General have already tweeted out that your legal arguments are rubbish and you're going to lose when it comes to court. So we're not worried about that at all. I'm also not worried about any of your, things are bad so we can't certify arguments, because that's just ridiculous. You certified in August when they were worse. Less than 50% of the ballots were recountable. Now over 72% are. 58% of them were even balanced when it was less than 30% last time. So it's doubled. It's gotten way better because the Secretary of State actually jumped in and did her job, unlike you. But I know it's not going to change your opinion. You talked about not certifying Detroit, even though you acknowledged that Livonia, a city, by the way, I know you know is 95% white, had bigger variances than Detroit, which is 80% black. We understand, and you've now added your name. So I'm not gonna try to change your mind. I just wanna let you know that the Trump stink, the stain of racism that you, William Hartman, and Monica Palmer have just covered yourself in, is going to follow you throughout history. Your grandchildren are going to think of you like Bull Connor or George Wallace. Monica Palmer and William Hartman will forever be known in southeastern Michigan as two racists who did something so unprecedented that they disenfranchised hundreds of thousands of black voters in the city of Detroit because they were ordered to. Probably, I know, Monica, you think Q told you to do it or some other crazy stuff like that. But just know, when you try to sleep tonight, that millions of people around the world now on Twitter know the name Monica Palmer and William Hartman as two people completely racist and without an understanding of what integrity means or a shred of human decency. You, the law isn't on your side, history won't be on your side, your conscience will not be on your side, and Lord knows, when you go to meet your maker, your soul is going to be very, very warm.
That was a commenter named Ned Stabler reacting to the news that the two Republican members of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers had decided not to certify the results of the election in Wayne County, Michigan. He was one of countless people to voice their glaring opposition to this 11th hour power grab by the GOP. And his is exactly the level of outrage that everyone should have at today's news.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
If Donald Trump loses, there is a real danger that he will try to overturn the results and steal the election. And we have a very good idea of how he'd try to do it. This isn't a conspiracy theory. Trump has repeatedly told us that he won't accept the results of the election if he loses.
It'll end up being a rigged election, or they will never come out with an outcome. They'll have to do it again.
So the only way they can take this election away from us is if this is a rigged election.
I don't want to see a crooked election. This election will be the most rigged election in history.
That may sound impossible, but unfortunately, our election system is poorly designed and vulnerable to an attack by a would-be autocrat like Donald Trump. Here's how it works. There are two vote counts that determine who wins the presidency. The first count is of voters' ballots, and it happens between now and December 8th. While there's no hard deadline for states to finish counting voters' ballots, federal law creates a strong incentive for states to finish by December 8th. The second count is of the Electoral College votes themselves. When you vote for a presidential candidate, you're actually voting for a slate of electors, actual people who vote to elect the president. Those 538 electors, collectively referred to as the Electoral College, then vote to choose the president. Each state's electors meet in their state on December 14th. They vote for the president and send a record of their votes to Congress. Then, on January 6th, the newly elected Congress, not the current one, counts Electoral College votes. This count in Congress is what actually determines who the president is. If Trump tries to steal the presidency, he'll do it by disrupting both of these counts. Between Election Day and December 14th, we should expect Trump and his allies to disrupt the ballot count and try to delay it past when the Electoral College meets on December 14th. His campaign could file legal and administrative challenges against ballots. We may see armed white supremacist militias attempt to directly prevent boards of elections from counting ballots. And Trump may even order federal agents to seize ballots or halt the count in some places. Creating chaos, delaying the ballot count, and potentially making it impossible to complete the ballot count before the Electoral College meets on December 14th would all be intended to sow public doubt about the legitimacy of the election. That's when the Republicans would make their move. Normally, the governor of a state is responsible for certifying which candidate's electors should be appointed to the Electoral College based on which candidate won the state's popular vote. This is where the constitutional crisis could begin. Republican state legislatures in key swing states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, each of which has a Democratic governor and a Republican-led state legislature, could declare that the election has been corrupted by fraud, that an accurate ballot count is impossible, and that Trump is the rightful winner. The legislature could then vote to illegally appoint a second, rival slate of Trump electors to vote alongside the legitimately appointed slate of Biden electors on December 14th. That would result in the state sending two contradictory votes to Congress. This may sound far-fetched, but it's happened before. In 1876, four states sent competing slates of electors to Congress in the election between Democrat Samuel Tilden and Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. The result was a major constitutional crisis. Following protracted negotiations, which concluded only days before the inauguration, the two parties reached a political compromise to determine the winner. Hayes was sworn in as the president in return for the withdrawal of federal troops from the South, thus effectively ending Reconstruction and ushering in a century of Jim Crow. If a state sends two slates of electors to Congress, Congress must determine which electors to count and which to discard. And if that happens and the outcome of the presidential election comes down to a vote in Congress, we can be sure that Republicans will do everything in their power to make Trump the winner on January 6th. They'll do that even if it means violating political norms and even the law. What we're talking about is not an election, it's a coup. We will be in a fight to save democracy. The good news is that if Trump tries to steal the election, we can block him if we take decisive action. If Trump tries to steal the election, we need to protest by the tens of millions. And we need to keep protesting until Trump concedes and leaves the White House. A contested election won't be a legal fight. It will be a struggle of political will. And we need to demonstrate that the American people will not tolerate a coup, that we will fight to defend the Constitution. But protest will not be enough. We also need elected Democrats to do their part. Key swing states, including Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, have Democratic governors, and Democrats have control of the House. Democrats may also take control of the U.S. Senate in this election. That gives Democrats the power to stop Trump if they treat this like a no-holds-barred political fight to save democracy. Biden has to be willing to take the fight all the way to Congress. If Trump prevents all of the ballots from being counted, or if Republican legislatures appoint fraudulent Trump electors, Democratic governors need to be willing to appoint Biden electors. Democrats in Congress need to do whatever it takes to stop Republicans from counting illegitimate Trump electors, up to and including shutting down Congress and preventing Electoral College votes from being counted.
Donald Trump is still engaged in a diabolical form of voter suppression, and America remains a divided country.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Hello, and welcome to the Faith Report, where evangelism meets social justice. This is Nia Gray with this week's Faith Report. Today, I'm going to review the film Come Sunday, a 2018 Netflix film based on the excommunication of Carlton Pearson, pastor of the Higher Dimensions Family Church, run by televangelist Oral Roberts. Pearson was eventually declared a heretic by his peers in 2004. In his early career, Bishop Carlton Pearson rose through the ranks of the Church of God in Christ, and in 1981, he formed his own church, which became one of the largest churches in Tulsa, and he lived large in the 1990s. He hobnobbed with presidents like George H. Bush and was one of the highest-rated televangelists on Christian TV. He made a lot of money preaching the teaching that if you're not saved, then you go to hell, and all that didn't accept Jesus as their Savior would spend eternity in hell. Things started falling apart for Pearson after watching a television program about the wretched conditions of people suffering and dying from the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, which made him reconsider the teachings of his own church that non-Christians were going to hell. He said he received an epiphany from God, that God told him, stop telling people they have to get saved to avoid hell. Tell them they're actually already safe with God and don't need to worry about hell. He stated publicly at his church that he doubted the existence of hell as a place of eternal torment and quickly lost his influence in the evangelical fundamentalist church. And later, his own church closed and he had to file bankruptcy. In 2004, the College of African American Pentecostal Bishops concluded that such a teaching was heresy. I am not going to use this time to debate universalism, whether non-Christians can be saved in Christ, which is inclusivism, or whether salvation occurs only after the profession of belief in the Lordship of Jesus Christ, which is exclusivism. According to 2 Peter 3:9, the Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness, but is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. When hell is spoken of in the New Testament, it's typically reserved for the self-righteous, like the Pharisees, who were the religious leaders of the day, who rejected God's provision for their salvation, attempting to justify themselves through their own deeds. He didn't condemn the Jews because of their sin, but their hubris. And the Bible is full of stories of God using imperfect people for his perfect will, like a murderer, Moses, a prostitute like Rahab, or the cowardly Gideon, who God referred to as a mighty man of valor as he hid from his enemies. Part of our faith walk is to try to understand God's mercy and justice. And it's hard for us to wrap our brains around because justice and mercy don't typically coexist in the human existence. However, rather than contradicting each other, the two actually go hand in hand. God's justice is his mercy. And Pope Francis said, to his divine mercy, we should readily and generously share that message of redemption with our brothers and sisters.
Pastor Carlton Pearson will tell you that Tulsa is the city of his prime and of his crime. His ministry was a sudden and bright supernova before it burned out in a spectacular crash that left Pearson shattered for straying from the story as it had always been told.
But with the release of a new movie that documents his fall, he's never felt healthier, happier, or holier, with a powerful second chance at finding a new kind of spirituality.
Things that I feel like God has called me to do is bridge gaps, not only between cultures and nations and denominations and people, but generations.
20 years ago, Carlton Pearson was a bright and shining shooting star, arcing across the sky of Pentecostal preaching.
You know what I'm talking about.
A suave, sparkling skyrocket of a man who mesmerized Tulsa's powerful evangelical community.
Rises up inside of you.
I lived that way. I had mastered the craft of it.
And a close friend of your parents.
A protege of Oral Roberts, a graduate of his university, he ministered to 5,000 followers every Sunday at his Southside Higher Dimensions Church, and with his Azusa conferences to standing room crowds at the Mabee Center and the Downtown Convention Center.
I knew what to say over the pulpit. I knew what words they needed to hear.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for coming.
He was a regular guest on global Christian television, and because of his serious polish, he began appearing on mainstream TV, whose bookers saw him as a legitimate voice rather than a sideshow curiosity. He was named a regent of the ORU Board of Directors, counselor to presidents, part of the National Healing after the Murrah Building bombing in 1995. And though Carlton Pearson seemed to have it all,
I kept feeling unsatiated, unsatisfied, and I didn't know why.
He became bored with everything he built.
It became tasteless to me. Didn't taste bad, it just had no taste at all.
And so restless and questioning as he approached his 50th birthday 15 years ago, Pastor Pearson began to listen to that which had been stirring inside him.
I came up with the conclusion that we probably got it wrong. And we misinterpreted that instead of the Bible being the inspired word of God, it's probably just the inspired word of man about God.
He began to preach inclusion, that everyone goes to heaven and that there is no hell.
I just couldn't reconcile in my mind eternal torture, weeping, wailing, gnashing of teeth. It didn't make sense. And my experience of God was not that way.
But in turning his back on a spiteful and angry God, he unleashed the wrath of what he calls Christianity Incorporated. He was suddenly a mortal threat to the business of the Bible.
And so when something happens that threatens the community or the doctrine or the dogma or the tradition or the cult belief, everybody gets defensive.
His fall was to be quick and complete.
Some people just turn away from you. That's painful, but it's more bitter when they turn against you.
Other pastors began to attack. He was barred from Oral Roberts University and removed from its board. And its namesake, his mentor, the creator of the prosperity gospel, warned him that preaching inclusion would destroy everything they'd built. He was declared a heretic and would lose his home and his friends.
I baptized those people and counseled them and prayed with them and gotten some of them out of jail and been to the bedsides when they were there, when they were dying. And I just didn't think that covenant would ever be broken.
And as his congregants at higher dimensions began to flee, leaving him unable to pay the mortgage, he lost his church.
I just didn't think that would happen. But when it did, that's when I knew, wow, this is big and this is bad.
I want to ask you something.
It's his story of loss and redemption that's told in the movie Come Sunday, a sleeper hit of last month's Sundance Film Festival. Taking part in its production has been both cathartic and painful.
And did you love it?
Here we go again. A movie will come out. There'll be critics. My name will be used. The people who are angry at me will become angrier. The ones who love me will love me more.
And though a public mea culpa could get it all back and more.
I've had millionaires come up to me and say, if you change your message and go back to what you were, I'll buy you the property, I'll buy the building. We miss you, we need you, we want you as you were.
And when the devil knocks you back.
He says that Carlton Pearson is dead.
We love you at All Souls.
The reborn one, the newly energized one, is the Pastor Pearson who makes monthly Sunday visits to All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, and the one who can now reach hundreds of thousands around the world from his living room with Facebook and YouTube messages. Messages he hopes that offer a new perception of God for the 21st century.
The message that we have received, for which we paid a huge price, has opened a whole new world for us.
It's the message he's convinced his mentor heard as the two sat together and Oral Roberts approached the end of his life.
But I convinced him, I think, and when I finished, he stood up, and there's a scene in the movie about he put his hand in his back pocket and he looked up to the ceiling and he said, I've listened very carefully to everything you said. Long pause. And I like what I hear. Man. That was as close to an affirmation as I was going to get.
And to an older, chastened, and yet happier Carlton Pearson, that now serves as quite enough.
I think there's so much more to God than we have tried to imagine.
This has been Nia Gray with your Faith Report.
Fellowship, let's go.
My testimony is real.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race. At Let's Talk About Race, we never underestimate the intelligence of our listeners. Therefore, we introduce our new segment, Book Love.
While these may feel like the worst of times, the present may be some of the very best times for literature. Voices that had been shut out, shut up, and shut down are starting to be heard. And not just one or two writers, but 10 and 20 and more. Case in point is Deesha Filia's first book of short stories entitled The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, a title both intriguing and mystifying as to what direction the author has chosen to go, like what kinds of secrets. Well, it doesn't matter, because it is the whimsical and brilliant ways Filia introduces each of the 9 short stories that enchants the reader and will not let you go. This small paperback of about 175 pages, published by West Virginia University Press, is deceptively about common people, but with complicated and uncommon lives. I enjoyed 2 things most about each of these sometimes hilarious, sometimes heartbreaking stories. First, the dialogue is superb. These women have brains, and they articulate thoughts that blast past the ordinary, the banal kinds of expectations of unimaginative portrayals too often of Black women. And 2, the clever and sometimes brilliant ways each story is crafted by Filia makes these short stories that can be read in short sittings, if you can wait, a delicious literary treat. My favorite story is titled Ja'el, about a 14-year-old girl, and it is alternately told by the voices of Ja'el and her grandmother, who kinda accidentally discovers her diary and then very intentionally, continuously reads it. Ja'el and her grandmother are from a family that has produced 7 generations of all girls, and the grandmother describes the family naming tradition. The oldest woman in the family would open the big family Bible and point her finger on the page. Whatever woman's name was closest to her finger, that was the name of the girl child to be born. I am reminded by that tradition of one of my favorite Toni Morrison novels, Song of Solomon, in which the illiterate father, Macon Dead, makes the blind selection from the Bible and names his daughter Pilate after the man who killed Jesus. Is there a connection in what Filia implies in her story? These are some of the reasons why The Secret Lives of Church Ladies is so surprising, so well-crafted the reader will want to read it twice. Here is a passage so beautifully and sparingly written that what is most profound doesn't hit you over the head. But if you are close reading, you can't help but feel it in your gut. We would come together for the naming, my mother and her mother, when they were living, my sisters and me, our children, and then their children, and so on. We'd cook and eat. We'd ask Father God to bless the mother and the girl child yet to be born. We'd laugh and tell stories, and someone, usually whatever man was around at the time, would always ask, "But what if it's a boy?" And we just laugh some more. Even if we was arguing, fussing, and fighting with each other just the day before, the tradition brought us together. We honored tradition. What else were we going to cling to? We had five living generations when Jael was born because we had our babies young at 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. Ain't no shame or pride. Just the way it was. A family full of women, and we had the worst time with men. The good men died young, and the terrible ones stayed just long enough to make you wish they would die. God forgive me. Some years back, the news people came and did a story on our family reunion. It was on a national program. But now my mama, my aunts, my sisters, my daughter, Jael's mother, all gone, except my baby sister Vashti, some cousins, and the nieces and great nieces. I guess the rest of them just naming their babies any old thing now because I don't hear from them. Maybe even had some sons. Who knows? Jael was the last one I named, and she is my cross to bear. And I named the ones I didn't give birth to, the ones I drank the tea and got rid of. Lord Jesus, forgive me. Anna, Shamia, Ruth, Barbara.
My agent would come and hear me read the short stories. And finally, after one of the events, one of the readings, she said, these stories with these church ladies, they're really great. And while you're kind of on hiatus from that novel, for the last decade, maybe you could do a short story collection with these church lady stories. And at that time, I hadn't really thought of it as church lady stories, but these were just the stories that, came to my mind. But at that point, at her suggestion, I got really intentional about writing a collection, a series of stories that all had church ladies or people that I call church lady adjacent, that there's a church lady in their life that who is influential. And so where they came from initially, I think it's just they just live in my memories because I grew up in the church and I watched church ladies a lot. I was very curious about them and they just kind of stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And so when I started imagining and thinking about situations or people, questions, they were the ones that popped up.
The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Deesha Filia is on the short list for this year's National Book Awards.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about great, baby. Let's talk about you.
Race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTARshow or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
Help me now, baby! Please! You gotta help me! Cause I need somebody! I need you right now! Come on and let me know that you need me, dude! I'm gonna tell you this one.
Listeners, it's another big give day for Willamette Week's Give Guide. Just for today, Give Guide has a Black Pack Black Friday offer. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get a chance to win a handmade, made in Portland backpack from Black Pack.